welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar. I'm Ian Welsh, and I'll be your host for the next three quarters of an hour or so. We are going to be talking about how to implement living wages and create meaningful change on the ground. Despite ambitious commitments to wages across the apparel sector, academic studies show that low pay continues to be the status quo. There is still widespread confusion, not least over the definition of a living wage. Action with suppliers and in factories varies greatly across regions. Today, though, I'm joined by two labour issues experts from sustainable outdoor apparel brand Patagonia, a company that has been working on living wages for over a decade. With us, we have Wendy Savage, Director, Social Responsibility and Traceability, and Alex Katz, Manager, Supply Chain Social Responsibility. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Tanya Richard, for helping to convene our discussion today. Living wages and other labour issues are, of course, major challenges for the apparel sector and will be among the matters discussed at Innovation Forum's Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference in Amsterdam on the 28th and 29th of April. Full details of the already impressive participant lineup and how to attend are on the Innovation Forum website via the link on your screen now. And worker rights and compensation will also be part of the discussion at our Ethical Trade and Human Rights event series in London and New York this spring. Full details on the Innovation Forum website. Okay, I will shortly invite our panellists to answer some opening questions to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open up the debate to audience questions. Now, we do want to hear from you all, so please submit questions using the box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. Please try and keep your questions short and to the point. If you do, it is more likely that I will use them. And as usual for Innovation Forum sessions, we have no presentations today, just discussion. We are recording the audio, and you will receive a link to this in due course when it is edited and published on the Innovation Forum podcast channel. Okay, turning to our panel, Alex and Wendy, as I mentioned just now, Patagonia has been working in living wages for over a decade. So thank you for joining us today to share some of what you've learned along the way. So let's start with some definitions. Alex, what is the difference between a minimum wage and a living wage?
A minimum wage is a legal requirement that may or may not be adjusted on a regular basis and is often set as a result of negotiation between employer representatives, worker representatives, and governments. Unlike the living wage, it factors international competitiveness into its negotiation. And that's why major manufacturing countries have low minimum wages so that they're able to remain competitive and attract foreign investors. On the other hand, a living wage is generally not required by law. For the most part, it's become part of voluntary standards like the Fair Labor Association's Workplace Code of Conduct, and is thus a requirement for organizations who subscribe to those voluntary standards. In principle, a living wage is an amount that enables a worker to afford decent food, housing, healthcare, education, childcare, and other necessities for themselves and their family. And this last point is important. The living wage is a family concept because for societies to thrive, the population must be able to sustain itself. And therefore, the living wage is intended to support the standard size family for the location in question, which should be four people at minimum and larger than that in some locations. The living wage is a regional concept as the cost of basic necessities varies from place to place.
And I guess this variation from place to place makes things ever more complicated. How should living wages be calculated then? And why are estimating the living wages so important?
Already a complex topic, living wage calculation methodologies, many of them have developed over time because no single methodology currently covers the entire world. We're doing the best we can to research available living wage estimates, and we work closely with the Fair Labor Association on that task. In any case, the living wage is calculated by defining what a decent standard of living means locally and then studying the costs required to get to a decent life. For example, a local nutritious diet must be defined and priced out that reflects available ingredients that are commonly consumed in the area. Decent housing, likewise, must be defined, taking into consideration materials that are available and must be used in a locality to withstand common weather events. So an example would be a wooden house with a zinc roof in the Dominican Republic. That's a house that wouldn't be considered decent because in that country, hurricanes are very common and would decimate a house made of those materials. So for the Dominican Republic, a decent house would be one made of concrete, and the cost of housing would be based on the cost of a concrete structure. The reason that living wage estimates, and particularly accurate ones, are critical is that in our conversations with our supplier partners, we found that we really do need a number to target, and that target has to be accepted by the supplier partner is valid. And it's extremely helpful when that target is accompanied by a detailed report explaining what went into the calculation. We find that estimates produced using the anchor methodology are the best example of this, and our supplier partners are buying into them. When setting a target, it's really an important factor when planning wage increases with the supplier. This number is factored into the cost of doing business, so there's a real practical need for that number, we find. And finally, for us, living wage estimates are helping us benchmark the wage levels in our supply chain. We're able to compare current worker wages against living wage estimates and group our supplier partners into categories, including those who are paying a living wage, those who are close, those who are a little bit farther, and those who are farthest. And that helps us set strategies for the work we do and keep track of our progress over time.
Perhaps I can turn to Wendy. Given what Alex just said, why can't brands just pay more for their products to get to a living wages then? Or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, paying a fair price for a product is definitely part of the solution, but living wage is more complex to achieve. So in all cases, brands can pay more for their products in order to increase their workers' wages. It may work in some cases, especially, for instance, if a brand owns a factory or the brand is buying the majority of the products there, perhaps that can work there. But the reality nowadays is that most brands don't own their factories, and that there are, on average, probably 7 to 10 other brands sourcing from the same factories, where living wages is not required by law. So their independent factories are independent businesses, and we can't, as brands, impose asking them to pay more for their workers. So theoretically, just paying more may be part of the solution, but in practice, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And the other point is that what we're trying to do is trying to figure out a sustainable solution to living wages, not just one that happens while we are there as a brand. So trying to come up with ways that our suppliers can see that this is important. Prices alone won't work, but it involves working with other brands, working with governments, just several other ways that we need to ensure that living wages are sustainable, not just while the factory is there, while the brand is there.
I guess there must almost be an element of, if you're there and you're bringing in living wages and then you're no longer there, what happens to the wages then? But perhaps that's something we can come back to later on. I know that you're pretty confident or pretty sure that fair trade is the first step to getting towards living wages. Wendy, so with you, why is that?
That was our first step. Still, it is our first step. And as we studied the challenges with implementing living wages and knowing that we could not simply put the responsibility on our supplier partners, we started exploring different ways. How can we quickly bypass the barriers and put our money where our mouth is and help the workers? And so at the time, Fairtrade had started its apparel and home goods program. And after we studied it, we found it to be really a brilliant way to immediately contribute to workers in our supply chain while we continue to look into how we were going to implement living wages sustainably. So through the Fairtrade program, we pay a premium on top of the price of each of the products we buy. And all that money goes directly into a bank account that is managed by the workers, by a democratically elected worker committee. And so the factory doesn't touch that money. The workers decide how to use it. And, you know, sometimes they may use it as cash, divide as cash bonus, or sometimes they decide to go on projects. We've seen mostly that that's the case, building a crèche, a daycare center, ensuring there's teachers and things to support the kids, just other necessities that wages alone will not help buy. So it's been a very important program for us as our first step, and one that is giving us the time to find the sustainable solution, but at the same time, helping workers.
Well, that's a good start. I think we've talked quite a lot about the why. So let's move a bit to the how. So Wendy, how would you classify your approach to getting towards living wages then?
It's very methodical, where we're trying to identify a whole menu of options for our factories. There's no one size fits all in this solving this problem. There's no one magic formula or one magic way to do it. We have to approach it as a menu of options. we look at it from an experimentation point, collaboration, learning, and education. And we are learning through this process, we're learning a lot from our suppliers. So we do have suppliers who are already paying living wages. So we're studying how they've been able to implement this. They don't call it living wages, it's just part of doing business. And so we are learning to see how they set up their businesses in a way that they're able to pay living wages to the workers. We use a lot of data. So we try to make sure that our discussions and our decisions are data driven. So we've spent a lot of time gathering a lot of information from our suppliers and from the workers. We're working with the industry. So through the Fair Labor Association, who's sort of the backbone of this work for all of us members of the FLA, there's a lot of great collaboration and discussion at the FLA. And most importantly, and this is something that you'll probably hear a lot during this conversation, is fine-tuning our responsible purchasing practices. RPP, we call it RPP, responsible purchasing practices. We feel that it's at the heart of getting to living wages. And when I talk about responsible purchasing practices, that means how are our business decisions impacting the workers and the way factories are able to meet the living wage, for instance. So it goes into costing, it's planning, it's sourcing, it's all of these different things that we as brands do that will set the factories for success or put the brakes on things that they need to do. So RPP is very important part of our approach. And the other important piece is education of consumers. We are in the process of putting together a lot of information that will be on our website on why this is so important, why consumers need to get engaged, and why they are part of the solution as well. So that's a little bit of our approach.
Okay, thanks a lot. Alex, self-evidently, achieving living wages is not something that a brand can do on its own. So who do you work with on your living wage initiative to move the journey along?
Sure. So since we've been doing this for over a decade, the list is extremely long and we don't have enough time to go into detail on every single stakeholder involved. So I'll list quite a few and I'll go into detail on a smaller number. So the list of stakeholders internally is very important as externally, arguably more so. Within Patagonia, of course, we're working within our social and environmental responsibility department. And we're also working with the sourcing department, planners, product line managers, our chief operating officer, our head of product, our CEO, and then PR, marketing, legal, and HR. Not all at the same time, certainly at different times, but they all have a very important role, whether it's making sure that living wage is bought into internally and then working externally with our suppliers and other partners. Externally, we're working very closely with the Fair Labor Association and Fairtrade USA, with Martha and Richard Anker, the Global Living Wage Coalition, the MIT Sloan School of Management, and a few expert consultants. And we're corresponding with an initiative called Action Transformation Collaboration, or ACT, the Fair Wear Foundation, Fashion Revolution, and Baptist World Aid. So I think that's a fair representation of the organizations we tap into regularly and at least annually. When talking about internal stakeholders, we really wanted to emphasize that to make headway on living wage, an entire organization really needs to be bought into the concept. So the first thing we needed to make sure is that the owners, the CEO, and everyone below was supportive of living wages before we could do anything outside. You can't accomplish living wage progression by tasking one person in the CSR department to do it. You have to involve many departments. And if they're bought in, they're going to offer the business-oriented solutions that are practical and necessary to move the needle. So within Patagonia, we actually established over 5 years ago a living wage task force that meets at least quarterly and is composed of our CEO, COO, our leaders from sourcing and our social responsibility teams, and occasional participation from HR, quality, and our product teams. Furthermore, internally, you can't get to living wages without looking at your responsible purchasing practices, meaning the actions businesses take that can have a negative impact on suppliers and workers. You can't have irresponsible purchasing practices and work towards living wages at the same time. For example, how are you going to expect a supplier to pay a living wage if the prices you pay are cutthroat? Another example is, how can a factory offer a consistent wage to workers if a brand is cutting their order volume halfway through the season? So these are real issues that businesses around the world deal with, and we're working over time to continuously improve on. Going externally, I want to start with the Fair Labor Association. That's a non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C. that we're a founding member of. And their mission is to combine the efforts of businesses, civil society organizations, and colleges and universities to promote and protect workers' rights and to improve working conditions globally through adherence to international standards. As a brand member, we've been working with the FLA and a variety of stakeholders who are also members to make progress on the living wage since the FLA incorporated the living wage into their standards in 2011. Wendy already mentioned Fairtrade USA. They've been an integral part of our living wage efforts. As she mentioned and you mentioned, we call Fairtrade our first step, and we've been working with them for a few years, actually, prior to the launch of our first Fairtrade styles in 2014. And the last group I want to talk about is Martha and Richard Anker. They are our living wage gurus. They developed the Anker methodology, which is the methodology we've adopted for our living wage work. We did an extensive evaluation of living wage methodologies around the world, and we found the Anker methodology to be absolutely remarkable. They're truly special and dedicated to this issue. Martha, before she retired, as a statistician with the World Health Organization, and she brings that expertise into her work, particularly when doing research into the diet for a particular location and the cost to afford that diet. And Richard was a longtime economist with the International Labor Organization. During the course of their careers, they studied the living wage and all available methodologies. And in 2011, Richard actually wrote the foremost analysis of all available living wage methodologies, which you can find online for free. Likewise, in 2017, Martha and Richard published for free a manual on how to estimate living wages around the world using their methodology. At this point, a whole host of organizations, including ourselves, are using estimates produced using the Anker methodology. And one organization in particular, the Global Living Wage Coalition, has published 26 living wage estimates using the Anker methodology for 21 countries. You can find that on their website. I mentioned this before, but the beauty of the Anker methodology is that you don't just get a number, you get an incredibly detailed report that painstakingly details the research that was performed. And it includes photos of what constitutes both substandard and decent housing, food, and other basic necessities, which is really important for getting stakeholders to buy in to the living wage figure that's been calculated. I can't stress how important transparency is when it comes to defining a living wage and getting buy-in. For us as brand practitioners, we can't move the needle on living wage unless we have a reliable estimate. And fortunately for us, the factories we're working with accept Anker estimates due to their rigor, the transparency, and their professionalism.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed. Some fascinating stuff coming in. I'm sure it's going to be prompting questions. I've had a load of questions already from the audience, but please do put your questions into the question box, and I will get as many of them as I can to Alex and Wendy before we finish. Okay, you've given us some great narrative around what you've been doing, but there are going to have been some significant bumps in the road, I'm sure. So Wendy, what have been the main obstacles that you've been facing in moving towards paying living wages?
Right. So I think, we're starting with very low bars, right? So country required minimum wages, the required by law, are very low. And so we're starting with low baselines, and there's a lot of work to be done to raise those in their specific countries. We have learned in general, but not always, that where the minimum wages are relatively higher, the gap to living wage is relatively lower. And Vietnam, for instance, is an example. But yeah, it's a big challenge to have governments that want to keep their wages low to remain competitive. And that is a challenge when we are having these discussions with our suppliers, and the suppliers are saying, well, we are paying above, you know, our minimum wages, but not close to living wages. So why should I, you know? And we as a small, medium brand, having leverage to have those discussions is very challenging. And I think from the beginning, the biggest hurdle was just breaking the taboo of talking about living wages. For many years, I've been in CSR for many years, and nobody wanted to, it was like the forbidden word, living wages. Even now, you know, talking about a living wage is very is scary for brands and suppliers. So getting over that and trying to explain that this is a very important conversation that we need to have, and having the suppliers understand this for us, that we're in it together, that this is not something that we're expecting the suppliers to resolve alone. You know, helping them understand that has been a challenge. The other one is lack of trust. You know, at the beginning, we spend a lot of time developing trust with our suppliers, transparency both ways. And so in order to gather the level of detailed data that we need to really truly understand where our suppliers are in their journey to living wages, it requires a lot of trust building. And so we spend many years earning that trust and ensuring that, you know, we are going to be together in this solution. So getting the trust from the suppliers to share their data has been challenging, but, you know, we've passed that hurdle now. I would also say trust is that does not allow us as brands, like when we're talking brand collaboration, we can't really share, you know, cost, the cost, how much we pay the factories, how much the factories, you know, charge for goods. So it is very difficult to have brand collaboration when there's so many things that we can't talk about because of this antitrust law. So we're trying to figure out how to have meaningful conversations and still, you know, protecting or not violating antitrust. And the last one, I think, is an obvious one, is there's a lack of examples of how to get to living wages. You know, there's not one model. And so there's going to be a lot of trials and errors. And, you know, we want to talk about both, about, you know, hey, we were successful here and this one didn't work and maybe this one would work. And that is challenging as well, because anytime anybody talks about living wages, it's just not enough information for the other stakeholders that want results right away. And so not being able to give fast results, it's a big hurdle as well.
Sure. Wendy, I wanted to ask you about the significant things that you've learned. But I wonder if in answering that, you can actually answer a question we've had from the audience. And it's quite specific. I mean, we've covered it a little bit, but how do you go about paying living wages if other businesses to whom that supplier is also supplying just refuse to do so? What's the kind of the key thing you've learned from your journey to try and make that, you know, persuade that case?
Yeah, I mean, those are the types of conversations that we're having at the FLA. You know, it is very difficult for a factory to guarantee living wages if only one of their brands is, you know, paying a fair price for their goods and having responsible purchasing practices, etc. I mean, and that is where the brand collaboration and trying to appeal to the other brands at the factory comes into play. But there's also a power of suppliers, you know, where suppliers need to start deciding who to do business with. We do have suppliers who flat out say, you know what, we don't work with this brand or this other brand because they don't believe in what we're trying to achieve for our workers. And so there are many suppliers out there that are screening brands, and that, you know, I think as the years go by, there will be more and more factories that would interview the brands before the brands go in, just because they want to ensure a level of quality and a level of of good, doing good for their workers as well. I don't have the answer. It's still something that we're trying to figure out. And hopefully through the work that we're doing with the FLA, we can come up to some models that we can share in the future.
Thank you very much indeed. Alex, I know that it's the living wage issue is one that's still one that everybody is still at kind of relatively early place along the journey. I know these things are always a journey, aren't they? But do you have any resources? Again, this has come up frequently in our questions. What resources do you think that brands and consumers who are interested should go to? What are the key resources that they can go to? And perhaps we can share these after the webinar.
Sure. I mean, I think it's safe to say that now more than ever, there's more information about the living wage available for access online. And there are organizations out there who are completely dedicated to increasing the transparency of people who are working on the living wage. So if you want to get started, there's a number of things that you can check out immediately to be informed and figure out your place in this environment. First of all, of course, I'd point brands and consumers to the Fair Labor Association's website, which contains a lot of information about their strategy and also contains a list of their members. So for consumers who are asking, can you share a list of responsible brands? Well, you can look at brands who are members of multi-stakeholder initiatives like the FLA. There's also a few other multi-stakeholder initiatives around the world that are more European-based. There's one called the Fairware Foundation in the Netherlands, and they're an incredible organization that actually published a guide in 2016 called the Explorer's Notebook that answers a lot of questions of living wage, contains a number of examples of members of the Fairware Foundation who have made progress on living wages in innovative ways. Likewise, the Ethical Trade Initiative, another multi-stakeholder initiative out of England, writes about the living wage and its brand members are working on the topic. I would also point out people who are interested to a few advocacy organizations that are focused on living wage. Two that come to mind are Fashion Revolution, specifically the Transparency Index Report, which they release on an annual basis, and the other of which is Baptist World Aid, which releases the Ethical Fashion Guide, also on an annual basis. These organizations have slightly different methodologies. They both engage with companies and look at what companies have published online about their living wage strategies and progress. Fashion Revolution only uses information available online. So if we're doing work that isn't published on our website, we don't get credit for it. Baptist World Aid, on the other hand, does engage with companies and does parade information into their grading that isn't necessarily just available online. So those are excellent places to start. Global Living Wage Coalition website is great to access living wage estimates for places around the world. MIT Living Wage Calculator has living wage estimates for zip codes in the US, around the world. That's a great place. Living Wage Foundation in the UK has living wages for England. So I'll stop there. That's a good place to get started.
Sure.
Ian, I'd like to add one.
Of course.
I'd like to add one, since we've been talking about RPP, Responsible Purchasing Practices. The FLA has a great guide on when you're thinking of your organization and evaluating, how are we doing on responsible purchasing practices? They have a great guide that I think you can download. And that's a great place to start, internally, to have those tough conversations with your CEOs, with your VPs of sourcing, because a lot of times it takes education and it takes time, and even for CSR practitioners like us, it has been so educational for us to learn about sourcing and learn about costing and learn about the challenges of planning and really the challenges of having a business. And that has helped us understand how to best navigate the living wage projects or things that come to mind looking at it through the business eyes as well. There's, I can't emphasize how important it is for CSR practitioners to learn the business and put yourselves in the shoes of your VP of production and your VP of sourcing, because you know, you have to look at it from all angles. And this RPP guidance is very interesting, and it can start conversations.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Alex, I wonder if you could answer a question. We've had a load of questions about the anchor methodology. Does it consider gender pay gap differences, or is it just a single number? Does it take into account the kind of gender pay gap problem?
Yeah, so I think that that's a question that's been popping up around the world, certainly from investors who are concerned with the gender pay gap in factories around the world. From what I understand, the anchors are actually coming up with an answer to that that they're going to publish. So I would defer to them so you can hear straight from the horse's mouth. But certainly local conditions, including number of wage earners, are taken into account, which is very important. Some places around the world, you might have a household where only one person works, both people work. There's an average that has to be looked into in those cases. The people who take care of children at home might be family members rather than child care service providers. That's definitely true when you're looking at the one end of the socioeconomic spectrum. So those are factored into the anchor methodology. I think I've heard some criticism that it's not factored in, which I don't think is well informed. What I would say for the definitive answer to that question is to look for what the anchors publish in the near future that directly answers that question.
And anchors, it's A-N-K-E-R, isn't it?
That's right, A-N-K-E-R, yes.
Okay, great. All right, load of questions come up around engaging in factories and the kind of difficulty of that engagement. And in particular, and this is something that comes up a lot around lots of the different labor rights issues and others. When do you consider leaving a factory or a country if you're not succeeding in moving towards living wages at a rate that you feel is acceptable? And Wen, did you want to have a go at that one?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting question, one we get a lot, actually. And I would start by saying we invest a lot of time in picking our suppliers and selecting our suppliers very carefully, even before we place purchase orders. I think there's a lot of information on our approach. It's called the fourfold approach, where we vet our suppliers to make sure that they're not only good on, you know, quality and business and price and all of that, which is very, very important, but that they also have a philosophy that values environmental impacts and social responsibility, our social responsibility requirements. So we spend, gosh, on average, probably a year to 2 years evaluating a factory before we purchase orders. And during that time, we determine whether or not the supplier is committed to working with us on improving, you know, all of the areas that we ask, you know, from environment to social to living wages to just, you name it, all the programs that we have. And so that is very important for us to ensure commitment. We do take drastic measures if we do see that, you know, there's no fast movement, especially when there's lack of transparency. That is very critical for us. So in these discussions about living wages, we spend a lot of time educating our suppliers as to why it was important to share the detailed information, signed NDAs, you name it. But if we see that a supplier is not opening up, I mean, we involve up to our COO in these conversations, and we have tough conversations. If we see that there's no movement, that there's no wish for transparency, then we have to have the tough conversations as to are we going to exit? Because if there's no transparency, then none of the projects that we're trying to do with a partner, there's no partnership if there's no transparency for us. So, yeah, we do have those conversations every so often.
Sure. Okay. And I guess, as for so many supply chain issues, data very, very important for when you're working with your factories and your suppliers. Number of questions on data. Alex, I wonder if I could come to you. Are there any specific data points that you find particularly useful that we might not have thought of?
Right. Well, it's very difficult to get a sense of what workers are earning in total from a very quick data gathering exercise. You can't just look at the base rate that workers are earning to understand what's going on in a factory. So we've worked over time with the Fair Labor Association and other member brands, as well as the MIT Sloan School of Business, to figure out a way to collect data efficiently that gives you a better snapshot into what's going on at a factory and adds up not just what workers are earning in their base rate, but also the bonuses, incentives, benefits that are provided that help you build a picture of what's going on in a factory. And from what we've seen from our suppliers who have better performance in terms of paying a living wage, it's that they're providing a compensation package that really takes into account the major needs of their workforce. A lot of our suppliers actually who are paying a living wage or are close to it didn't think about the living wage when they were setting their wage levels. They studied the cost of goods in the location. They were understanding what workers' major needs were when putting together benefits packages and offering a competitive package that really attracted workers, led to good retention rates and low absenteeism, a lot of motivation at work. So there's a lot to learn actually from looking at what suppliers are doing who have better wage performance. But I would suggest reaching out to the Fair Labor Association to understand the data gathering tool that they have available and that we're using for our factories to get a sense of what's going on per factory and overall in our supply chain. But one thing to keep in mind is that we have pretty strong relationships with the suppliers we do business with. That's based on trust. That trust isn't something that happens overnight. It comes from our personalities and our philosophy of the work that we do, wanting to work with the best suppliers around the world to share our values. And that leads us to the ability to ask for information that's sensitive, like detailed information about the wages that workers are earning, and not have our suppliers react negatively, thinking that we're going to use that information against them when it comes to setting the prices that we're going to pay to them. So, you know, there's a lot that goes in internally to setting the stage for doing this work effectively and being on the same level as your suppliers, not a relationship that's adverse, but really equal partnership.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question, again, reflecting a lot of the questions that have come from the audience, is around the role of consumers in driving all this forward. I mean, clearly, Patagonia is a brand that I would imagine your consumers are going to expect to be on top of these sort of issues. So what for you then is the best way that consumers in other brands can leverage leverage the brand to move on living wages? Is there a role for consumers there? And you know, what kind of reaction and what engagement do you get from the consumers on living wages? Wendy?
This is something that we talk a lot about. Consumers definitely have a role, and a much more important role than they probably think. It's really when consumers start asking the hard questions that brands start moving. And yes, you know, we are in the outdoor industry where consumers are aware of the impacts in the environment. But this is with organizations such as Fashion Revolution, such as Baptist World Aid, all of these organizations that are raising awareness on the fact that you can vote with your dollar for the brands that you trust and that share your values. And the fact that you can't possibly expect a $5 t-shirt or a $2 t-shirt to be a responsible product. And so, you know, consumers nowadays are asking more questions and are demanding more information. And so I keep comparing it always to the organic movement, right? I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, the organic was not as popular as it is now. Why? Because there's more consumers that are it's more in demand. And so it's the same thing with this. You want responsible products, you have to ask for it. You have to ask the tough questions and then push brands to answer. So yeah, as a consumer, if I'm gonna go purchase something, I want to know how are those workers being treated? How are those workers being paid? What are the hands behind the label? So yeah, they have a big role.
Sure. Okay. Wendy, I know you have to leave very promptly at the end. So I want to ask a final question to you, and then perhaps I'll come back and a final question to you, Alex. But so Wendy, we've talked about it a lot. It is a very daunting topic. Clearly Patagonia have made some great progress here. What advice, Wendy, do you have though for brands who want to support living wages but don't know where to start?
Yeah, I would say there's always a place to start. I would say start internally and have those conversations with the CEO, with the owners. Where are their heads? Do they see this as an important thing for the company? Because really, if the owners of your company are not interested in it, it would be very, very difficult to move the needle. So I would say the internal conversations are the most important, educating all of the internal stakeholders. And then go from there. You know, it doesn't have to encompass everything. You want to start with one factory, you would one of your best partner suppliers, start with them. When we started Fair Trade, we started with one factory and six styles. This was 2012, 2014, we had our first Fair Trade certified six styles. And now we're over 70% of our styles, our factories are asking for Fair Trade. The benefits that we're seeing, are tremendous. And so, you know, don't think that you have to fix it all at once. It will take time. And the first and most important conversations are to be had internally.
Okay.
I think that's the simplest.
Well, thank you, Wendy. And that actually leads me very well, very nicely into my final question for you, Alex. What is your elevator speech to convince a CEO or board member to make this a priority in their agenda?
Yeah, I mean, the elevator speech is getting easier than ever because of all the attention being paid to living wage at the moment. I just had a conversation with a supplier the other day where I showed them a slide listing all of the organizations around the world, multi-stakeholder initiatives, activist organizations and campaigners, brands, all of those organizations who are working on living wages. It's just exploded over time. Some of the cases are more famous than others. Some organizations are newer to the game, but the fact that living wage has become such a priority, I mean, it's inevitable now. And publicly traded companies in particular are getting a lot of attention from investors. So I don't even think they need to hear it internally. They're getting it from the outside. But the fact of the matter is that to do business in a way that is responsible and connected to good performance, wages are central. We think about it internally at Patagonia, as many brands do. You need to compensate people to keep them, to attract and retain the best talent. The same is true for the supply chain. And the fact matters that in time, wage growth, there hasn't been a lot of wage growth. People have been earning the same amount relative to the cost of living for many, many years, and the situation hasn't improved. It's something that has to be addressed in order to ensure security for the supply chain and your business over time. And frankly, it's not impossible. It's not an issue that is impossible to address. There are examples out there. We're seeing it from within our supply chain of suppliers who are at the living wage level. So we know it can work. But as Wendy mentioned, there's no one size fits all. So there's got to be a bit of patience, a little bit of experimentation, and definitely a lot of collaboration to move the needle. Setting your sights small at first, just to show evidence that progress can be made before scaling up and trying to do something on a large scale.
Well, thanks very much for talking about how you've been doing that over the last 45 minutes or so. I'm going to have to stop the discussion now as we are running out of time. Thanks so much to Wendy and Alex for joining us, and particularly for joining us so early in their morning. Don't forget that similar issues will be discussed by experts at the Innovation Forum Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference in Amsterdam on the 28th and 29th of April. And I'm delighted that one of Wendy and Alex's colleagues will be joining us as a speaker. We will be in touch to share a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. For now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. I've been Ian Welsh, and thank you for joining us.